Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the 174th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire Internet Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you an American perspective of our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You get your daily reading from me and other writers over at SoccerNewsDay.com. Join in to the chat room. It's open right now. And talk amongst yourselves if you like. If you have a question for me, I'll try to answer it to the best of my abilities as possible. And before we get going here, first of all, happy holidays to everyone. Final show of the season. Want to thank everyone for listening to everything that's going on. And also at the same time, let me just say that this has been an interesting year for the show. And as always, I thank you very much for listening to the show and you taking my perspectives of what's going on with American soccer, with our leagues. A lot of things are going on within the leagues, obviously. A lot of stuff that's been probably discussed or, you know, talking about all these little private wars going on. But before I get into that, because we'll have a guest on around 8:30 to discuss this, I want to talk about something I saw that kind of really bothered me. And it came in those Nike friendlies, basically, when you have the U.S. men, the U.S. under-17s, I was going to say the men's, but no, this is the U.S. under-17 national team taking on Brazil, their under-17s. And, you know, when you defeat a quality opponent, it doesn't matter what age group it is, because Brazil is a very, very quality opponent. That if you get a victory against them, you know, hey, it just proves that the youth systems, the youth teams are getting better, they're improving. And I know it's a friendly, but still you feel pretty good about what could be the future for our national team down the road. But something really bothered me with how Brazil finished up the match with the remaining 5 minutes of regulation. And, you know, I found it terrible that the coaches – told their players not to continue with the play. Yes, they were down to 9 men. Yes, 2 of their players were sent off on very, very reckless challenges that deserved to be a red card. But when you have a head coach, and I don't care if it's a youth team or if it's the senior team, how dare you make a mockery of the game and tell your players not to attack the ball? Stay where you are. Don't bother playing the ball. Just stay there. Protesting. For what? Because 2 of your players committed reckless challenges? They got sent off for the right reasons? You know, if there were 7 men left on the field and the USA got 4 players sent off, they'd still fight. They would still fight to face their opponent till the end of the game because they have dignity, honor, and respect. And when one of the Brazilian players wanted to play the ball, the coach yelled at him and told him, go back to where you were and don't play the ball. You know, it's just amazing that this under-17 head coach decided to just tell his players, don't bother with the ball. Leave it alone. Don't bother with it. You got beaten 4-1 by a U.S. under-17 side. Brazil. These kids are fighting for the same thing that your kids are. And you have the nerve to do this, to tell these kids of yours not to play the ball? You know, we understand here in the United States that Brazil, Argentina are the two top powers in South America. Uruguay as well is in there. Colombia is up and coming as they're showing it. And we also know who the top countries are in Europe that are tough to beat, but hopefully they'll get that opportunity. I think some of the countries in Africa are starting to become a power as well. Ghana has had our number at least the last three times, twice in the World Cup and once with the under-20 World Cup this last summer. We can respect our opponents, but what we don't do is disrespect them and disrespect the game. I hope the CBF or the CFB, I hope they let this coach get suspended or, hell with it, fire him. Fire this coach for disrespecting the flag of Brazil, for the game, and everything else involved in that friendly match. That was absolutely disgusting. Because Brazilian football never, ever does anything like that. We've seen it numerous times. The class of the players, how they perform on the field, they're tough. They're strong, they're intelligent, and they're very difficult to face. The truth is simple. I don't have any ill will to the kids from the under-17s of Brazil. I have ill will with their coach that did the wrong thing and made a mockery of the game. And that is why I'm making a mention of it now. And that is why I am upset with how that match ended. Because there is no sense of respect from the head coach of the Brazilian under-17 team. You got beat. Deal with it. And tough nuggies to you, sir. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've got a great show for you tonight. The president of Soccer Newsday, my boss, I'll call him my boss for now, of course, is Mike Firpo, and he's also the head of the World Football Travel Agency. He'll be coming on. He wrote an article about what's been going on between all our professional leagues here in the U.S. and why there might be a divide. And then, of course, my good friends Earl Reed and Robert Hay Jr. joining me. They are the U.S. of Football podcast. They'll be joining me at the tail end of this show as we talk about everything going on in U.S. soccer. But my first guest is my good friend Neil Morris from the Independent, down in Cary, Raleigh, and Durham, North Carolina, talking about the North American League, North American Soccer League season. The split season, and apparently there's a problem with a 9-game spring season schedule, which I agree there is a problem because there shouldn't be a 9-game regular season spring season schedule, but it has happened, and he couldn't come on live. Obviously, it's the holidays, so interviewed him on this recorded session, so please enjoy this. This is Neil Morris covering the North American Soccer League as well as the Carolina Railhawks for the Independent down in the triangle of Cary, Raleigh, and Durham, North Carolina.
And this is, once again, the Four Seasons Fire Internet American Soccer Show. Joining me at this moment is a man that covers everything in the North American Soccer League and the down in Carolina Railhawks and Cary, North Carolina, as well as the rest of the league from the Independent, Neil Morris. Neil, thanks for your time and happy holidays.
Thank you, Daniel. I appreciate coming on during a sort of busy off season for the NASL, and happy holidays to you as well.
Absolutely. Real quickly, though, before we talk about our main topic, of course, two teams right now, their ownership situation kind of in financial flux, but then it looks like that everything is sort of new now. Tampa Bay Rowdies, they have a brand new member of the front office, Bill Edwards, becoming the principal owner. And in the Atlanta Silverbacks, Mr. Jurasevich now with the Harden brothers, Henry and John, who will be joining him in the ownership group, which, in my opinion, it's a great thing to hear when you can know that Traffic is slowly losing their grip, which they don't want to be part owners in so many teams in the league.
Sure, and I guess it's what all these teams need to aspire to is solid ownership, and especially solid local ownership. Now, only time will tell how viable these new ownership groups are. We've seen a lot of very attractive-looking owners end up being paper tigers. But I don't want to get off on the wrong foot with these guys. It's certainly good that Tampa is getting added resources and added connections to the community. It is a solid franchise, but always seemed to be sort of one step away from a solid financial foothold in the Tampa-St. Pete area. And hopefully the addition of Bill Edwards as their new chairman and CEO will give them not just more resources, but also an added connection to the cultural community there in Tampa. He's been a sort of a philanthropic figure down there for a while, been involved in various endeavors in St. Petersburg. It's a strong signal that the Rowdies are going to stay in St. Pete, although that probably was going to be the case anyway. But hopefully it will end any kind of sort of whispers about whether Tampa was in dire straits from year to year. Atlanta is very interesting. We had heard about this new ownership turnover for a while. It's been known that the league was attempting and was in the process of trying to divest themselves of at least their majority ownership in Atlanta. That's been going on for a few months. The identity of the new majority owners was a little bit of a secret. Everyone knew that Boris Dracunica was going to sort of re-elevate to a majority owner. He was a majority owner and then was a minority investor, and now he's back as one of the majority owners. The longtime vice chairman, John Latham, is still there. And then the new additions are Henry and John Harden, who run a human resource outsourcing company, SCI. And so this enables Traffic to at least not be the majority owner of the Atlanta Silverbacks. I ran an article a couple weeks ago when Atlanta fired their coach, Brian Haynes, rather surprisingly. And Coach Haynes told me that it was his understanding that the league was going to continue to be a minority investor in the team, which, by the way, wouldn't be a lot different than sort of unofficial sources that I've heard over the years that the league has maintained a minority share in a couple of teams, perhaps even Minnesota, if for no other reason than a way to offset potential liabilities going forward for at least for a certain period of time. I certainly have no confirmation or no official confirmation of either of those things, but what Coach Haynes told me would fit into what I've heard was the case in other markets. So, but it's certainly good that they have new majority ownerships, if for no other reason beyond financial stability or hopeful financial stability, then it gives them an independent voice, an independent support system, separate and apart from the league or Traffic, who have their own interests. And I think it's something that it gives Traffic majority ownership in only two other clubs, and one of those is the Carolina Railhawks. And I think, and this may drift into our next topic, but that kind of independence is something that is extremely valuable as league guidelines and formats and rules are being promulgated.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking about that, Virginia Cavalry, who are supposed to enter the league next season with Indianapolis, the Indy 11, and Ottawa Fury, they've decided to push it back to 2015. It was supposed to be a 10-game schedule for 2014 spring, but now it's 9, and I just don't understand why they can't keep it at a 10.
Well, I think a lot of people are asking that same question. Everything, going back just a little bit, your audience is probably familiar if they follow your show, that the NESL decided to keep their split regular season format for 2014, but they decided to shift their midseason break to coincide with the World Cup. That, plus the calendar and the climates and all the rest of it in various markets, essentially created a situation where the league decided that they would run a 10-game per team spring season, followed in mid-July by a 20-game fall season. Every team would play each other once in the spring and twice in the fall, with the spring season winner still determining both a berth in the soccer bowl and who would host the game. And that created a little bit of consternation because a lot of folks, some didn't like the split season format to start with. I'm not one of them. I still support it. Some didn't like the idea of having just a 10-game season determining a soccer bowl berth and a host of the game, particularly when, you know, you've got 10 games, you're playing each team once, and who's going to play where, who's going to play home, who's going to play away. And so that was there was a little bit of angst over that. But I think everybody had kind of put that to the side and was ready to move on with the new season. Well, you know, I started having some suspicions about the Virginia club, although I saw their management team, including their what seemed to be prospective head coach, John Harkes, at Soccer Bowl weekend in November, and it appeared that they were, at least outwardly, were still on the way to next year. But, you know, while Ottawa and Indy 11, who are also joining next year, were busy putting out press releases about signing coaches and players and all, and season tickets and all the rest of it, Virginia wasn't doing anything. The only thing you heard was several months ago when they tacitly broke ground on the multi-use stadium that they and a minor league baseball team were going to share up in Loudoun County. And then you didn't hear anything else. And usually when you don't hear anything for that long, then something's going on. And despite statements from the league that we were hearing that everything was on course, it didn't seem that way. So then when Virginia backed out of 2014 as a whole and decided to instead come aboard with play beginning in the 2015 season, it lowered the number of teams for next year from 11 to 10, which created, if you kept the same format for the next regular season, you've got a 9-game spring season followed by an 18-game fall season. So everyone who had a problem with the shortened spring season, it got one game less. But then last week, the league came out and went ahead and announced their spring season and didn't make any changes to their format, other than removing Virginia and creating an odd number of games for the spring season. So now you've got a 9-game sprint determining a soccer bowl berth and hosting rights for the soccer bowl beginning in mid-April and ending mid-June,
mm-hmm.
or early June.
Yeah.
And to me, although, you know, the bigger issue, and this is not just me, this is a lot of other writers who cover the league, and I've talked to some front office folks, including Kirk Johnson, the president of the Railhawks. I talked to him yesterday, as a matter of fact. Folks are not happy about the 5-4 split in home games, because there's 10 teams and 9 games in the spring season, with so much riding on the result of that spring season. Math dictates that 5 teams are going to have 5 home games and 4 teams are going to have 4 home games. And that's what we have.
Yeah.
And the 4 teams that ended up, I'm sorry, the 5 teams that ended up having the extra home game, if you want to call it that, were the Cosmos, the Rowdies, the 2 expansion teams, Ottawa and Indy 11, and the 5th one was the San Antonio Scorpion. So that left the remaining teams that ended up with only 4 home games during this spring season were the Railhawks, Minnesota United, Atlanta Silverbacks, Fort Lauderdale Strikers and FC Edmonton. Now, you know, I'm not going to sit here and speculate as to why that happened. You can look at the teams in each category and come to your own conclusions of how they ended up where they ended up. I know that the league said that the determination of who got the extra home game came down to individual markets and their blackout dates and scheduling issues. Well, you know, I talked to Kurt Johnson yesterday, who has known about this for a while and, needless to say, is not pleased about it. And he said there was no scheduling issue that would have prevented Carolina from having a fifth game, and he has no idea how they determined who would get the extra home game.
Yeah.
First team president. So, you know, it's a dicey situation as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where it invites speculation as to how certain teams got in certain situations, especially with so few games in the spring season, and especially with so much riding on it, and especially with everything else, with so much angst amongst team presidents and team coaches, especially over the split season format to start with. So it's an odd thing, and I'm, again, I guess we go back to this whole lack of transparency thing. You know, certain things happen and you don't quite know why.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would have gone with having Atlanta facing Carolina for the 10th game, whether the return leg will be at Cary or down in Atlanta, Indianapolis in Minnesota, Ottawa in Edmonton, Tampa Bay in Fort Lauderdale, and probably the only one that wouldn't work, but you'd have to do it anyway, would be the Cosmos and San Antonio playing each other for maybe the 10th game when San Antonio does not go to Long Island. I mean, that's, to me, you keep the 10-game season at least.
Right. You could have done it. And I actually spoke to someone who said that that was something that was you know, one possibility, some kind of regional 10th game, or you could have just put all the names in a hat and drawn out 2, 2, 2, and 2 and done it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could have, or if you just wanted to kept it at 9 games, you know, at the very least, put all the teams in a hat and draw out the names for the ones to host the fifth home game. At least make it random.
Absolutely.
But that didn't happen either. And I talked to a couple of people who strongly believe, and of course this is not a universal belief across the league. I think amongst many club management, their opinion still is that the interests next year of avoiding, of maintaining the split regular season and avoiding play during the World Cup presented pillars that they wanted to abide by, but it left them with imperfect options to do that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's fine. But, you know, and that's a whole different line of conversation of whether, a second division American club needs to worry about avoiding World Cup play, or instead of beginning the fall season in mid-July, they should push it to early July to take advantage of holidays and that kind of thing. But that's a different, slightly different topic. I think the problem is, once Virginia backed out, there was a strong number of folks who believed that the league should have taken a step back and come up with it and sort of approach their format from a different direction and a new consideration, knowing that the problems that were already there with the format next season were just exacerbated by Virginia's dropping out. And there was no real rush to get the schedule out now. I don't think the regular season schedule came out until January last year. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, I understand that there's folks working hard on this, and a lot of the interest of the league as far as maintaining the split regular season is something that I agree with.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start knocking down so many other things, like shortening your spring season to 10 or 9 games, and having teams with an inequitable number of home matches, which is not just an issue of competitive balance, Daniel. It's also a matter of revenue. You've got half the league with one fewer home game. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. No.
And those are tickets and concessions and everything else. So, and for that to be determined seemingly willy-nilly is something that I know. This isn't just me talking. That's left a bad taste in some people's mouths.
Yeah, I don't blame them. I don't blame the teams that feel slighted that they're going to lose a home game. Like I said, you know, whatever the suggestions were, I agree with them. I know you agree with my suggestion, even though that was even considered as well.
Yeah.
It's just unfortunate that the situation has popped up, and hopefully it won't happen again when you have these expansion teams coming in ready for a certain season, and all of a sudden they can't make it because of their stadium situation's not completely ready. But other than that, Neil, you know, I guess the only way to get through it is to play the schedule and the hand you're dealt with and try and get to that Soccer Bowl berth.
Well, that is true. And at the end of the day, you know, all things are ultimately determined on the field. And, you know, last year, two teams with the lowest player personnel budgets in the league performed well. You know, the Railhawks, which is a traffic-owned team, had the best overall record. And Atlanta, who was then a traffic-owned team, won the spring season and, you know, and came close to, you know, playing well and winning the Soccer Bowl. So it's not the be-all, end-all. However, I think that at some point it becomes a cumulative issue. And when you have these new owners coming in with resources, like we talked about earlier, who are joining other owners with added resources, which is a good thing, you know, spending may increase. And, you know, you look at a team like Carolina or Fort Lauderdale, who are still owned by Traffic, which has the smallest player budgets in the league. It looks like the rest of the league is at least appears to be moving forward while these teams are stuck where they are. And then you throw on top of that, you know, these format changes in the regular season and having a fewer home games in the rest of the season, I mean the rest of the league. You know, at some point, you know, mm-hmm. on-field results become dependent on these other issues.
Very, very true.
And, you know, in the case of Carolina, just briefly, and I don't mean, I don't mean to sound like I'm whining, but I think it's emblematic of every team that's in this situation. Carolina has four home games during the spring season. You would think that there would be some accommodation for that in the scheduling, but Carolina not only has only four home games, they also open on the road at Indy.
Mm.
They close on the road at Edmonton.
Oh, God.
And their other road games, they have to go to Ottawa, San Antonio, and Minnesota. So not only do they only have four home games, not only do they open and close on the road, but all their road games are the four farthest road games. So it's a brutal schedule.
It really is.
They don't have any road games in the Southeast United States, despite the fact that you've got Tampa, Atlanta, Fort Lauderdale all in the league. So it's tough. And yes, you got to get it done on the field, but at some point you start to wonder when these things, not just for Carolina, but for other teams, you start to wonder where this cumulative effect starts to become a bridge too far.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Neil, thank you very much for the insight, and thank you very much for the information. Once again, happy holidays to you and your family, and happy New Year as well, and I'll definitely talk to you in 2014.
You as well, Daniel, and I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Same here. Take care.
Thanks.
And that's Neil Morris from The Independent. Very interesting stuff going on with the North American Soccer League having only nine games in the spring season. Definitely not enough to do anything big, but, you know, this is what they've done, and I would like to think they should have gone to 10 games, at least do a regional game again. You know, Fort Lauderdale versus Tampa Bay, of course, Indianapolis versus Minnesota, Edmonton versus Ottawa, Atlanta versus Carolina, and I know Cosmos San Antonio would not be a matchup, but still, though, you got to do what you got to do to make it at least even a little more understanding. But that is done with that. And joining me right now, of course, is the head, the president of the Soccer Newsday Media Group, as well as the president and owner of World Football Travel. It is my boss, Mike Firpo. Mike, thank you for taking the invitation and welcome to the show for the first time.
Well, thank you for inviting me. That was unexpected and really nice. I appreciate the honor of being on your season finale.
Oh, thank you, boss. It's pretty cool. But anyway, you know, first of all, I have to say it was a well done article. I really, really feel that you got the gist of what's been going on here, and it's not just the bickering that's been going on that we can definitely see within the leagues, but at the same time, that little interesting, shall we say, argument between Grant Wall and some of the bloggers from, I mean, that was just absolutely crazy. I couldn't believe he did that.
Yeah, and it's kind of what, I guess, I had no intention personally of writing. I'm not a great writer. That's why we have 50 writers, because they're good, you know. So I occasionally write on bigger topics, things that aren't covered. But this was one of those things that just came about by accident. But you know, what's funny is, you know, when you write, and you know this, you know, most of the time you're gonna hear a lot of, you know, critiques, and a lot of it negative. It's just a lot easier, you know, for people to critique in a negative way. And then this one, It just wasn't that way. I mean, almost every single thing that I've heard back from people, and there's some people that just usually just disagree with me, just to disagree, and they're on the same page. So I know that this means something. I know that this is really kind of either touched a nerve or exposed a nerve, you know, in North American soccer. You know, the thing with Grant Wall and Keith Hickey that night, it was last Wednesday. It's that's more indicative, to be honest with you, of Twitter, you know, and just that nature of communication, and internet, you know, and it's just very easy for people to either pick fights or not know how to get out of them, you know, and that was just a tough one, but when you look at it, you know, overall, you know, when you look at it overall, is it a problem between, you know, the professional media and the amateurs and the bloggers, you know, and all these, you know, kind of fan ambassadors, you know, that fill the airwaves, you know, in podcasts and blogging online and such, or is it a bigger problem with, you know, North American soccer that we just can't get out of our own way, you know? I mean, because you look at it and you see, you know, the other, that's not sexy. That stuff's not sexy. You know, the people followed it. Some people said they were chewing, you know, eating popcorn or, you know, giggling about it, you know. But in the end of the day, Grant Wall has 330,000 Twitter followers. So the guy's on to something. He does something very well and very correct, you know. And that's not to say that Keith doesn't. But, you know, but I think it's more, you know, that we just have to figure out how to work together. You know, you see it with the leagues. You know, you were kind of just, talking a little bit about it with Neil, with the minor leagues. And, you know, we just see expansion, and we're expanding into the same places, you know.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, there's already now three teams in the state of Oklahoma. There's two in Oklahoma City. One NASL, one USL Pro, and then now all of a sudden Tulsa's coming in, and
right.
I mean, I know Tulsa's not far away from
exactly an hour or so away. I mean, and it's great. Would you love to come back? The Roughnecks had their own following, a good following, you know, in the NASL days, and I believe there is, you know, there was interest in MLS back in the day, you know, going there when they had that stadium opportunity. But yeah, all of a sudden you throw a 2014 as a USL Pro team, 2015 as an NASL, and Tulsa's getting one in 2015. Maybe the NASL does the same thing. Sacramento, you know, they're going to go strong next year with USL Pro. I think the Republic's going to do really well, But does this mean the NASL comes in Elk Grove or the suburbs or somewhere else? Or we saw it with Tampa. It could happen in Atlanta between the NASL and MLS. Minnesota, maybe San Antonio. New York City is going to have a little bit of a battle between the Cosmos, you know, and the NASL mm-hmm. is the flagship team. And then you have New York City FC, who nobody really knows where their fans are going to come from, but they're certainly going to cause a stir, you know, between the three clubs when you include Red Bull, you know, in Jersey.
Exactly.
So it just seems to me, and that's why I wrote this, you know, and I think that's why so many people kind of, you know, cling to it, is it's something that we've all think about. That why are we doing this? Why are there two teams in Oklahoma City in the minor leagues? You know, and in that article I quoted a fan from Tulsa, and I basically said this is what the ground level looks like when you start doing this. And basically, you know, not to, you know, to paraphrase, he just said, why are we doing this? Why all of a sudden do we have all these teams? We just need one. You know,
yeah.
Let's focus.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You
absolutely.
Know.
No, I mean, well, I was going to say this. You know, we've had our conversation on Twitter, but, you know, we respect each other because, and this is before I joined Soccer News Day, you know, we've had our conversation on Twitter. We've had our little battles on Twitter. But the difference is that you and I, we respect each other because I know how well you've been in the market of not just promoting the game, but also, you know, with your business, with World Soccer Travel, World Football Travel, I should say. And you know how hard I work in trying to, you know, promote the game as well as, you know, promote the Red Bulls in Major League Soccer. But, you know, with the whole thing, it's like sometimes people are intentionally trying to start fights. That's what I see.
Yeah. You touched on it. It was a word you said in your intro with the Brazil, you know, and the U.S. national youth team game. Respect, and that really, and that's important, and that's the thing that it's you know, soccer is just this little subculture in North America, you know. But in general, with Twitter, you know, since I've joined it, our mutual friend Chris Anger, one of the writers for Soccer News Day, former, you know, RSL show podcast host, you know,
yeah.
He got me on it, and I was so reluctant, and then, you know, it really did change, you know, part of my life, and stuff like that. I really enjoy it. However, there are a lot of pitfalls. There are a lot of things that people just don't enjoy. I don't want to, you know, if you disagree, that's fine. Disagree. That's life, you know. But
exactly.
Don't start fights. You know, don't start fights. And again, like Grant Wall kept saying in the argument, I think, before he kind of lost his cool, you know, was that basically he tries to treat every blogger or anyone in his profession professionally. And, you
mm-hmm.
know, and gives them a chance. And I think that but at some point, if you can't get along with them or the attacks are focused from a certain place or area or person, well, then you just use the block button. It's the same thing in life. If you can't get along with someone, you're going to keep putting quarters in a broken machine? You're going to keep trying to have a bad relationship or a bad friendship or a bad work experience? No, you're going to leave. You know, and so
right.
It's the same thing. You know, it's just logical. You know, you don't want to deal with that. But in our little growing, you know, soccer world, we need to work together. And I just, you know, I raise my voice because I'm from the same part of the world as you, you know, and I get impassioned about it because I don't like it because it's something I love. It's something we all love. That's why we're listening. That's why we're talking. That's why we blog. That's why we podcast, you know, and that's why
yeah.
the fans jump up and down and spend, you know, a disproportionate amount of their income on this thing and time and love and passion. So when we hurt it, when we hurt ourselves, when we hurt our soccer, we have to sit and say, wait a second, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? Why is Hope Solo and Julie Foudy going after each other? Why can't Gold TV and beIN Sport coexist? You know, why can't the USL, the MLS, and the NASL get figured out by the CSA and U.S. Soccer? Why is that not possible? How is that? How, you know, why can't we figure this out?
Yeah.
So that's why I said we
no.
need a blueprint. We need a master
mm-hmm.
plan, or at least a coming together of a think tank of all the different parts. And that doesn't just mean the pros. That means the amateurs, the bloggers, the writers, the media, the fans, the supporter groups, MLS, and you know, NASL, USL, US Soccer, etc. We all have to work together and figure this out in expansion, how we're dealing with each other, working together, you know, and really stopping some of the redundancies too between AYSO, US Youth Soccer. We need better leadership at the top. And I think then we'll all have more resources and more time to work on the things that matter, like technical ability and how we're going to get these ratings, you know, improved, and how we're going to play good soccer, you know, all across the continent.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree. And, I mean, you know very well, of course, before the NESL came around, some of the teams that were in USL, they broke away because they didn't think that the way that it was structured was the right way to go, and they were going to try to find some form of a peace, but then you just couldn't find peace, and then they just broke off and became the NESL. And now, of course, you're seeing MLS being involved with the USL Pro League for some form of, like, affiliation now.
Well, you
and now
see
the NESL
a splintering.
Yeah, you almost see
a splintering because you're seeing the MLS go, obviously, a lot closer with the USL because of the relationship with USL Pro is basically becoming the reserve league or, you know, de facto reserve league for the MLS, which is fine and I guess works well for both entities for the moment. And then you also have the NESL, you know, maybe, you know, moving close to the NPSL, Division 4, so D2 plus D4 and D1 plus D3. Is that the right way to fix a pyramid that is one of the worst, you know, in the world? I mean, thankfully we have, you know, almost, you know, over 300 million people between the two countries, because otherwise we would be horrible. You know, I mean, we just have these sheer numbers and extreme wealth. So to fix over a lot of these problems, but our pyramid is horribly organized. And I'm not just talking about college soccer and the developmental academies versus high school soccer, but, you know, so much of it. When we're talking about the top players are going to D3, what about D2? How do you prove yourself in D1 by going and playing well in D3? Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't make
a lot of sense.
I mean,
in world soccer, in Germany or in England, would you go to D3? You would go to D2. So this is the problem when you don't have cohesion and when you don't have, you know, unified purpose. Things started to not make sense. And, you know, we try to rationalize them, but some of these things shouldn't be rationalized. We have to fix it. We have to work better together.
No, absolutely. Well, at the same time, I think, and I mean, look, I try not to be negative all the time, but the truth of the matter is this, is that the people who are running U.S. Soccer, Sunil Gulati, obviously, Dan Flynn, the general secretary of U.S. Soccer, I mean, we got to get everyone, not just Garber, not just Peterson, not just Holt, and whoever, and, of course, who's running NPSL, but even Gulati, we got to get him into a room, and we got to, like, find a way to get everyone talking in a civilized manner and hammer things out. I'm not saying, you know your role. You're MLS, you're Division 1, NESL, you're Division 2, USL Pro, Division 3, NPSL, Division 4. It's not just that. We've got to get everyone into the room and just have some form of an agreement to say, okay, this is what's going to have to happen, and if, you know, if it's not going to happen, then let's get someone else who can, because, you know,
well,
you don't want to see our leagues fall apart.
Right, because basically, you know, I mean, as the way world soccer is set up, FIFA basically leaves everyone to mostly just do what they're going to do in their own domestic sphere, right? In our case, it's two countries. But, you know, those groups, those entities, they get together. They do. But it's why can't we get through some of these obstacles? Why is it that youth soccer is still divided? Why is that? Is that sensible? You know, someone said recently something to the effect, I'm just paraphrasing, you know, how many technical directors do we need in Chicago? Or how many, you know, physical trainers do we need? And that's the truth. You want to get someone better, pay more. But you're going to have to maybe, you know, have a couple less sometimes. Because of the redundancies, we're spreading resources that are already thin, even thinner. And, you know, it's when you work together. And it's the same thing with the coaching licenses. I don't know if you're a licensed coach, but there are two different ways to go. You could go with the NCAA or you could go with U.S. Youth U.S. Soccer through the Federation. It's just two different ways to get the same kind of license. It doesn't make sense, you know. There's so many of these examples. But if we – so at some point you do have to start somewhere. So for me, start with the kids. Start with the kids first, right? And if you could figure out how to get AYSO and US Youth Soccer and clubs and US Club Soccer, et cetera, and all the entities at the bottom of the pyramid together, well, then you can make the next step. And then maybe you could go to the PDL and the NPSL, and then you could maybe go to the NASL and USL and say, how are we going to work together here? You know, you're the third rung of this tier. You're the second, and MLS, you're the first. And NESL, I know you have ambition, but you're still going to be two because you're not overtaking MLS anytime in the next, you know, decade or more. So, you know, let's all just work where we are and how are we going to work together? And better yet, you know, how do we maximize all of our own strengths, you know? So it has to start somewhere.
No, it does have to start somewhere. You're absolutely right. And at the same time, you just have to say that, you know, you just have this fear. You just have this fear that, you know, certain things are going to fall apart. I mean, here's something that I kind of find a little funny. Of course, everyone is asking Major League Soccer to switch to the typical international calendar, you know, what everyone in Europe does. You know, you start in August, then you go through till May or June, or probably till middle of May. But the thing is that people keep ignoring the lower levels because, I mean, college soccer is only like a couple of months.
Right. But
I mean,
there are a lot
you
of
can't
things
just have
that
MLS.
People want. Yeah, there are a lot of things that people want to do that sound good on paper. I would love that. I would love for. I would love that. However, you know, I was just also at the last MLS Cup, and my entire lower body was so cold after watching this game that the last thing in my mind was they're not even playing good soccer. You know, and then I have people tweeting me, "Have you ever played like that?" I don't even know if the professionals on the field have ever played like that. So you know, what logic gets thrown out, you know, for whimsy or for, you know, I would love, you know, for the MLS to be bigger than the EPL today, but it's not. That's not, you know, rational. What we want is not necessarily, you know, and Garber has said it so many times, and it's unfortunate it has to keep going on, but there are certain things that are just not going to happen today. And one of them is, you know, promotion relegation. Another thing is, you know, the international calendar. I don't see that coming soon, but possibly. But here's the thing. Look at the EPL. Right now, they're going to play throughout this entire holiday season. It's part of their culture. But you know, and their fan culture for even better, and TV culture. But here, imagine you're playing all these games here in the middle of an MLS season. How am I going to draw over 5,000 people to Columbus or Dallas, or forget about Chivas? How are you going to do that with soccer that's not at that highest level yet that we all want? It's just not there yet.
Right.
And in bad weather with no roofs in some markets, you know. Some of these people are just going to come out. I mean, and then forget about – then talk about Toronto. Then talk about the Northwest. Then talk about New England.
I know.
You know.
I know. And Seattle and Portland and Vancouver. I mean –
it's not rational.
I mean,
it's not
Vancouver
rational.
No, Vancouver's lucky that they do have a tractable roof. I mean, they can do it there, but Seattle doesn't have a roof, and Portland doesn't have a roof. Montreal, I mean, they can go into the Olympic Stadium, but then but then what's the point of having Stade Saputo when you're going to be in the Olympic Stadium for most of the time?
Exactly, and then you lose the quaintness and of a soccer-specific stadium. So, to me, that discussion doesn't even begin. I'm not usually in favor of it because of all those reasons. And because of the fact that the rest of the world, 200 countries, most of them, have no competition in sports. We have the strongest leagues in the world for the most part, outside of, you know, the IPL maybe in India and the AFL in Australia. We have the strongest sports rivals that any one nation could have, any two nations could have. So we can't – it's just – we're not playing in the same field that the rest of the – England can do that with no big problem. England could also change a fixture in 3 days, not even tell their fans, and still have 3,000 supporters show up and take off work. We don't have that like that. That's not realistic today, 2013. So there are certain things that people want what can happen. It's just – we're just not ready yet. And until we're at maybe 95% of capacity for all these stadiums, this is not even a discussion.
Right. I agree with you there. The only thing I want is a healthy, competitive, and a very well-supported U.S. Open Cup. That's all I want. I mean, I just want to see that's the one thing I think that we have to look forward to sometimes. It's like, it's not so much the mechanism of how leagues are done, but everything that's involving U.S. soccer. I mean, you know, this is I love this competition, and I want to see it done the proper way, you know, promoting
and
everything else.
And then you look at the NPSL Division IV, and right now there are as of today, there are 21 new clubs coming in. Expansion clubs. I think they're losing about, you know, 10 or so or 8 or something like that. But they're still up net 12 or 13, right? For the next year. So So when they do that, when PDL does that on the other side, unfortunately, of the same exact pyramid, you know, same exact part in the pyramid, D4, we have all these clubs that could potentially play, you know, MLS, NASL, USL pro teams, which is fun. That's the beauty. That's the Cinderella story, you know, the underdog story of tournaments like that, like the FA Cup, you know, being the best in soccer for you know, and we all want that. But okay, so really, you know, really quick, how do you get there when you have a minuscule, you know, prize for the team that wins it? It is not a big incentive. There's not enough of an incentive. The fact that that's not, you know, already sponsored, the name of the tournament already sponsored and sold, and using that money down, you know, to pay for the prize money. In 2013, we're going to be in 2014 with this same situation. To me, is unimaginable, and it goes back to that same point. Where is the leadership? Why are we still talking about in 2013 the U.S. Open Cup could be? Why are we not saying it is? You know,
yes.
And that's part
exactly.
of the problem when you don't have a blueprint and when you don't have cohesion. You know, and mm-hmm. clear leadership.
Absolutely, yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Before I let you go, I just want to ask a quick question. How is the other business, the World Football Travel? Because I go on the website a lot and I take
uh-huh.
a look and I'm like,
uh-huh.
wow, this is you really offer a lot of great deals. You offer a lot of great things. How's that been going for you?
Well, it's good. It's, you know, thankfully, soccer is played, you know, throughout the world and pretty much the entire year. So there's that, and then we have, you know, the World Cup coming up, which couldn't be any more chaotic. And We hope that all the stadiums are done, you know, and USA didn't get a great draw, you know, but yeah, no, people are still, you know, they go all over the world to go see matches. We're even seeing an MLS in North America now, you know, so there are a lot of fans that want to see games, and you know, I'm just thankful that I'm able to be a professional in our industry for a long time now, and you know, just be a part of this, you know, and for the most of my, you know, career was international soccer. But, you know, with Soccer News Day, you know, we're just mostly focusing on North America. And, you know, you see it with people traveling. You see it when the Northwest, you know, goes en masse, you know, with 50 buses or 1,000 to 2,000 fans to an away game. You're starting to see that culture, you know, the cultural change, you know, in how you're supporting your teams, you know. And it's granted, it's a heck of a lot harder here to travel, you know, 5 hours on a plane to see a match versus, you know, 2 hours on a train in Europe. You know, it's quite different. And coming home that
yeah.
night, you know. So, but mm-hmm. you're seeing it, you know, and I see it in my business and you know, and we're seeing it in North America all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was this? You're with the rest of the RSL in the corner at Sporting Park? I thought you got a luxury box up there. Come
nah,
on.
Hey, I'm not a wealthy man. No. I went with a few buddies, and we were on the, I think it was the east side, and it was my first mm-hmm. time at the stadium. One of my buddies runs the stadium. He's the VP. But yeah, no, it doesn't mean I get any help or anything like that. I was just one section away from all the RSL fans. But you know something, there was some great. You know, really a lot of nice people, you know, in Kansas City. And it's not just the, you know, the Missouri side, but you know, all the Kansas, you know, fans, that's where the stadium is. And,
yeah.
and just nice. We had some great conversations. It was just ridiculously cold, but you couldn't have a better stadium for that size in the world. And I've been to a few, you know, and I really find it's just perfect. If we and here's the funny thing. So while you're sitting there, all you hear is the locals talking about how they're going to expand it by 5 to 7 or 8,000 because they need
space
now. Yeah. Yep, yep.
Wow, that's pretty darn. I'll tell you though. I mean, they did very well for the qualifiers for the U.S. national team. I know they had the two Gold Cup matches. I think in 2011. I mean, you know, that's one of the greater, smaller stadiums. Just as Rio Tinto Stadium is even
yep.
one of the great stadiums in the state.
It is
it's
nice.
Just
it
been
is
unbelievable.
Nice. And here's the thing on both of those things, and it goes back to the original point again. You have, for the most part, one entity for soccer in those cities now. You know, you had so many issues before with, you know, the Wizards and that doesn't and Hunt did as much as they could, you know, and Lamar before he died, you know, he just passed it on to the best people he knew he thought could do this, and they did it, and that's a great story. It's great for MLS, it's great for North American soccer, it's great for Kansas City sports, but if they can do it, You know, we talked about it. A lot of people talked about it. Then anyone should be able to turn around their situation. Maybe even Chivas. I'm not sure. That's a little harder. It's a different story. But for the most part, if you do things right, focus your energies, focus your resources, you know, have a good brand, have a good name, have a decent name. I mean, people – that's important too. And then the stadium and the facilities, the temple to the sport, you know, it all has to be right. And with Kansas City, they've basically done everything right. And if they can, why can't we, you know, start, you know, imitating this or you know, maybe pushing some of these local, you know, or it's maybe not even MLS, maybe even, you know, NASL, to have multiple owners where they can pool their resources and where they can have a really good stadium and, you know, really invest. And then we take it to another level because when you see these markets that are focused like Salt Lake, like Kansas City, et cetera, they do well. They do well, and it's really not rocket science, you know. It's simple and it's focused, and then the fans can then go and paint their picture, you know, in the stands, and it's beautiful, man. When you're there and you see all these people in blue and waving these flags, and you think to yourself, man, they were lucky to have like 8,000, you know, a decade ago, you know, in Arrowhead, and now they fill this little blue cauldron. And it's amazing. It's something to see. And one of the girls in front of us said, "This is the place to go now, here." You know, that's an amazing thing. And you hear that this is, you know, it's the demographic, and you hear that from some of the MLS, you know, executives. It's becoming the thing, and that's important. And you do that by simplicity and focus, I believe.
Yeah, I really agree with you there. Listen, Mike, thank you very much for being on the show, and I really do appreciate it. And if you ever want to come back on again, you know, you're more than welcome to join me. And hopefully better things in 2014 for both, of course, Soccer News Day and World Football Travel. By the way, did you see my last article that
I did. Can we host the Club World Cup? We can. But tell me, how does Casablanca do? How do they pull if they get, for instance, you know, or not necessarily them, but let's say someone has Auckland City or Auckland FC, it would be hard in some cases. Whereas most friendlies, foreign friendlies in the United States, North America, are gigantic club versus gigantic club, or Mexican club. That's the formula. So when some of them would have to be scaled. So if you had Auckland FC or they were playing an Asian champion and there's not an Asian immigrant community in that city, you know, you're going to have to play at a smaller stadium for some of those games.
Yeah. No, that's understandable. So, believe me, I do agree with you there. Maybe Lockhart gets used for something like that.
But I do think it would be great for us to do it. I think with Canada as well, I think we can do it. I think that would be great.
Yeah, I think so, too. We'll have to wait and see if that ever does happen or if U.S. Soccer ever wants to do it. Thanks again, Mike, for being on.
All right.
And
happy
holidays to you and happy new year.
To you, too.
Talk to you soon. Thanks again.
Take care.
Sure. That's Mike Firpo, president of Soccer News Day, as well as the owner of World Football Travel. Go to worldfootballtravel.com. If you want to take a trip over to Europe or South America or anywhere in the world, obviously for the World Cup, UEFA Champions League, and from within Major League Soccer as well, in the NASL and any other places as well. So head on over there, worldfootballtravel.com. I have it bookmarked on my computer, that's for sure. And before we get ready for my next two guests, of course, they're friends of mine, news, of course, about three players that have played in Major League Soccer, Baca for San Jose, Michael Farfan for the Philadelphia Union. They have transferred permanently to Cruz Azul down in Mexico in the Liga MX. Jose Villarreal apparently is also going to Cruz Azul, but that's more of a loan deal. I guess he'll be coming back with the Galaxy. But if he does well, the guy from Los Angeles, Villarreal, I'll tell you, he could probably stay there if he wants to. And I think finally we're seeing from within our own confederation, especially against our big rivals down in Mexico, if we're seeing players now, good, young, solid players making the move to Liga MX, you know, I mean, that's really great. But at the same time, what does that say? I mean, that's going to be great for our national team, too, you know, Villarreal as a U.S. international. I mean, that's going to be great for us because he's, you know, for the national team and everything. But still, though, when are we going to keep our own and have him stay here for a long career? Obviously, I'd like to think we would be getting somewhere near there, but hopefully it will happen one day. You know, look, Eddie Pope, he stayed. He's the longest tenured guy I know coming from Major League Soccer since its inception, since 1996, and he stayed and never transferred or never went on loan somewhere outside the U.S. So that's the only notable guy I can make a mention of. Other than that, things are fine. Join me right now, of course, is my good buddy Earl Reed over from down in the Delaware area, who watches the Philadelphia Eagles. Of course, one half of the U.S. of Football podcast. Earl, thanks a lot for joining me as we're waiting for Robert to join us.
Hey, you're welcome. You hear me all right?
I hear you loud and clear as always, my friend.
All right. Excellent. Yeah, things are well. How are you doing?
Right. I'm doing all right. So let me ask you this. Michael Farfan now transferring to Cruz Azul. I mean, do you think this is the right move for him, obviously? Because I believe, was it Gabriel who's supposed to be, was he traded away to Chivas USA or went somewhere else? Was that Michael?
No, Gabriel Farfan went to Chivas USA.
Right.
Michael, yeah, he's now with Cruz Azul. It was kind of a sticky situation here the last couple of days because Cruz Azul actually announced Farfan as well as Rafael Baca and I forget the other player that was included in that. There was a three-player. Oh, it was Jose Villarreal from L.A.
Yep.
And they announced it, and Major League Soccer hadn't allowed their own teams to do any kind of announcement, so they had to kind of eat some, I don't know, not eat crow, but just it came across as another one of these bad PR moves. And the thing is, Union fans are already a little sour anyway because of some of the deals in the past that have happened and some of the other attacking talent in the midfield that they had in 2013 is now gone. Cleberson, obviously, Roger Torres. Just been a rough offseason, and you know, I think Philadelphia Union fans want to see some action going in the other way where, you know, John Hackworth and company are acquiring talent that's going to make the team better. And until that happens, I think there's just going to be a little bit of unease with the fans.
I was talking with Mike Furco from Soccer Newsday, who runs Soccer Newsday, as you know. There's a lot of not so much indecision, but a lot of infighting going on from, you know, MLS versus NASL, NASL versus USL Pro, you know, PDL versus MPSL, and so on and so on. I mean, when are we going to finally see something, you know, settle down and possibly just, you know, make some sense?
I don't know. And then the media gets into it this past weekend with Grant Wall and Keith Hickey on Twitter having a little row. Yeah, it's I don't know. It's like that's sort of like endemic of U.S. soccer at this point. It's just there's a lot of bickering and nobody wants to play well with each other. And I don't know. It'd be nice to see some kind of harmonious, you know, dealings with, you know, amongst not only, you know, mostly in the leagues themselves, you know, MLS, NASL, you know, I think there's like a, you know, sort of a tenor there that, like, people think NASL wants to be the first division, and, you know, that's not happening. And so there's just a lot of strife. You have NASL and USL Pro appearing to both want to be in the Oklahoma City area. just a lot of miscommunication and you know, it'd be nice if each of these divisions would. Obviously, one thing that's working so far is MLS and USL Pro are working together for a somewhat minor league setup. But yeah, you know, can't we all just get along?
Yeah, I know, right? Exactly. And now joining us, the other half of the US of Football podcast, Robert Hay Jr. Of course, Robert. First of all, happy holidays to you, sir, and a lot of moving and shaking over in D.C. since the only bright spot is a 2013 Open Cup title and a CCL spot.
Yeah, you know, it's been a busy offseason for D.C. United, probably not what a lot of fans expected at the end of the season in terms of moves. If you think about it, it's been kind of a bizarre offseason. You have a team that still doesn't have a stadium, still has the same general manager and head coach, despite the fact that the team finished with a, you know, record woes this year, but there's been a lot of changes on the field, and the team is certainly being aggressive in the off season.
Well, obviously Eddie Johnson comes over and he'll get his DP money. You also get from the reentry draft Fabian Espíndola, who made it clear he didn't want to remain in New York because I guess he felt he didn't fit there. But the question is this: does DC United have a midfield to feed those two strikers the ball?
You know, that's a good question. If you look at all the moves that have been made so far, they picked up Davy Arnaud from Montreal, and that's going to be an interesting acquisition. He's obviously a leadership guy in the vein of John Thorington last year, although hopefully he has a little bit more to contribute than John did this year for DC United. But yeah, you're right. You know, really, this team did need some help up front. Undoubtedly, considering, one of their leading scorers, I think, had 4 goals this past year. So, the ability for someone to score is essential. It's not easy to find those midfield maestros who can just provide that silky smooth service to lead to amazing goals. But, they don't grow on trees, but, a good striker does. And the ability to go out and get a good striker at least is taking that first step towards solving the scoring problem for DC United. I'll be interested to see how they line up the midfield, but it'll be an interesting offseason. I have a feeling they're not done, which is both scary and exciting at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, guys, we're going to go one at a time here on the questions, but I'd like to have your opinions on it. Earl, we'll start with you. Overall 2013 season in Major League Soccer, was it better? Did it start bad and get better as the season went along, or do you think there's been some regression?
I think there's some cautious optimism. Actually, it's funny, I'm writing an article, have it mostly written about this kind of topic, but, I think for me, still the attendance, while it seems to be a good thing, when you see stadiums like Houston, basically an orange bowl, and the orange is seats and not people in the seats, it's a little bit disconcerting, but, you have a team like Sporting Kansas City that is an obvious success, not only from the standpoint of winning MLS Cup, but also, you took a team that was probably on the ropes back, 4 or 5 years ago, and now they are, kind of like a model for how to develop a fan culture and how to take, basically rebrand a failing team. I think if other teams can start maybe taking some key learnings from that and applying them to their situations, maybe that's a way to get things rolling for other teams in Major League Soccer. So from that standpoint, I think that's a positive, but I think you got to start looking at some of these other teams and wondering if, when you have an attendance set that says 18, 19,000, but clearly it's not even close to, three-quarters full, maybe not even half full. I know it's paid attendance, but it's a little troubling. And so how is that all translating when it comes to fan growth? Cautiously optimistic. I'm just a little bit worried about that, and also the TV ratings probably not coming up in the way that they really need to for that next contract that's coming on the horizon.
Yeah, absolutely. And Robert, obviously the biggest question right now that Major League Soccer has is the television ratings, because apparently it seems that they're not striking where they should be or where the league hopes that they should be at the moment. Should we still fear this TV ratings, or, the league shouldn't have to worry about it because people are still coming to all the stadiums at least?
Yeah, I think I don't know if the TV is what I'd call the greatest concern for me if I was MLS. I think the discussion you all had prior to my chiming in the first comment was, I think, probably the overarching issue is where it fits in the soccer world. But to address your question directly, I do think that the TV ratings are indicative of a larger issue, or a couple of larger issues. The first one is the lack of creativity within MLS. I mean, the digital platform is pretty good, but I think at this point they're getting lapped by Major League Baseball and one or two other major leagues in terms of how they distribute their content digitally. I mean, the website is nice and things like that, but you still have a lot of stuff that's going out on MLS Live, which is has its glitches and is not widely available. So I think that feeds into it. If they are entirely dependent on TV ratings for their exposure and TV for the exposure of the league to the nation at large, and I think that they have a larger issue just because of the trends and demographics within the TV industry. And the digital, it doesn't look like it's making up for that. But I do think it also speaks to the attendance. You know, there are – if you look at the overall attendance numbers and take just look at the top-line numbers, they look very good. But when you dig down a little bit, there are some worries there. You know, the fact that Seattle holds up a lot of failing markets or markets that would be considered failing in other leagues. So not to say all is doom and gloom, but there are some concerns on the horizon there. And when you have a league that is aggressively expanding, you know, of course, everybody's going to bring up the ghost of NASL of the 1970s. And I don't think this is the same situation, but I do think there are lessons learned there, where the league hasn't exactly patched all the holes in its ship quite yet. In fact, there are still some leaks within the ship itself. If you look at Chivas USA, DC United, I'd still say the New England Revolution, despite the fact they made the playoffs this year, have an untenable financial situation, and so on and so forth. So I think that, to answer your question, you know, the league is doing pretty well. The TV numbers, I think, reflect, though, some of the weaknesses in the league itself, whereas it's not a total disaster of a property, although some of the ratings have been disasters for some of these games. But it just more expressed some concerns that the league should probably take a look at.
Earl, let me ask you this question, obviously, and it will go back to the TV side of things. You know, Major League Soccer has made this publicly known that they're thinking about, because they have this great partnership with Google, that they might be moving out of the TV business and having games being shown through Google Plus or Google Hangouts for these nationally televised games. I mean, I think it would be a major mistake if MLS gets out of the TV business when it comes to the national televised games, like on ESPN, NBC, as well as the Unimas or the Univision Deportes channels. What do you think? Do you think? I mean, maybe in the future, but I think this is a very bad idea if they're going to make this move.
Yeah, I mean, well, that would indicate where Major League Soccer really is concerned. You know, are they concerned about growing the game, or are they concerned about their bottom line and, you know, grabbing whatever payday cash out they can? You know, if Google's willing to offer them $30 or $40 million a year for this product to put on their platform, you know, basically to seed YouTube and this sort of subscription service with YouTube, yeah, they might, you know, look for a little bit of cash influx, but they're probably going to alienate some fans that are already there. And, you know, it's not going to do anything to grow the game, which, you know, that's sort of the quote-unquote, you know, thing that MLS is supposed to be doing in this country is helping to grow the sport. But, you know, there continue to be concerns that that's not really what they're about, and what they're more about is making every last cent they can off of the sport. And so when you see it, an outfit like NBC offer all their games to subscribers of certain cable, you know, most cable networks basically for free, you know, then you see MLS, you know, if they're going to go to a complete subscription service, it's just kind of like a backwards thinking, you know, they're going to be lapped by the competition, not only when it comes to other sports, but even in the sport itself with a package like the Premier League, which is a superior product on the pitch, no matter what Alexi Lalas thinks. You know, he can watch whatever he wants. You know, the vast majority of people are going to say that what you have the better product on the pitch is in Europe. I think that it's tough to argue that. So you've got that out there for free as opposed to Major League Soccer, where people will have to go and subscribe to something on YouTube. I don't think so. I think MLS would be wise to take what they can get from a place like ESPN or continue with NBC. NBC has produced some nice content for them. They need more of that and less of this, oh, we could do this all ourselves and, you know, grab whatever money's out there to, you know, profit ourselves. That's my view on it. I don't know about you, Robert, but that's
Yeah, I take a slightly different view. I think I take a slightly different view depending on how it works out. I mean, I think subscription service is the key here. I mean, if you think that you're just going to be able to make money off of televising games, whether that's on TV or the internet, then I think you have the wrong model. But if you're going into this Google partnership saying, you know what, you know, we are going to offer some stuff for free because really the internet is about free. At least in terms of content, and we're going to try and grow the market that way, I think that's a good idea. I think you hit on a good point, Earl, about NBC. I mean, truly what's grown the game in this country this year more than MLS has been the Premier League on NBC. They've done an aggressive job of, you know, promoting the games, and they've shown some results. I mean, there's been some pretty good ratings in terms of, in soccer terms, for Premier League games. And I think having that partnership where MLS can piggyback off of the EPL is huge, and they will never admit that. I think that the league would never admit that, even if you fed them truth-telling serum. But if you look at the numbers and everything like that, that's probably the best thing for this league, is to sit there and say, we aren't the Premier League. But we have our own charm. We have our own benefits. I mean, we're local. And, you know, when you're finished watching Manchester United play Manchester City, you can watch DC United play Red Bull, or, you know, Philadelphia play the Miami Beckhams, or, you know, whatever. And there's that local element. There's fan groups that you can join. There's games that you can see if you travel and things like that. So I don't think that it's necessarily a negative. I think it's just if it's approached the wrong way, it could be a very big negative. But if it's approached a different way, I think it could be a positive for the league.
Yeah, absolutely, Robert. Now this question is for you. Obviously, the white elephant in the room. It's really a goat, but
we're doing a white elephant. Oh, geez, let me go dig something out from under the bed.
But in all honesty, you know, we know what the problems are going on over with the Chivas USA club in the StubHub Center. Do you think Garber has enough power, or do you think he just likes getting money? Because let's be honest, you know, Vergara should probably be kicked out of the board of governors, or at least, you know, the ownership groups that help keep MLS going. What he's done, what's been done on HBO's Real Sports and everything else, all the different roster changes, the changings of the head coaches and everything else, do you think it's time to kick Jorge Vergara out of MLS, or do you think it's not going to happen?
You know, it's interesting. A year ago, I would have said absolutely the bum should get out, but if you look over at the Premier League, to bring up the Premier League again, you see some of the owners they have in the Premier League right now. I mean, Vincent Tan, who's basically trying to single-handedly screw up a historic franchise over there and things like that. Jose Vergara looks pretty small potatoes compared to some of that stuff. But in terms of what he's doing here, and I think that he really should reassess his ownership of the club. I mean, Don Garber and the owners really need to step up and say, you know, we need to invoke the good of the league at some point, because Chivas USA is a dead weight right now on this league. It's an embarrassment. You know, the Real Sports thing was handled very poorly by both the league and the club. And again, if the league wants to present itself as MLS 3.0 or whatever they're up to now, they really need to be able to handle situations like this, which are just really kind of embarrassing, how the team is running itself, how it's coming under these allegations and not responding or not caring to respond, and how it's not developing in a very rich soccer market. You know, I'm on record as saying the team should move. It shouldn't have to move, because LA is big enough and a great enough soccer town to support two teams, especially if you have, you know, a kind of an evil empire team and the team that's not the evil empire. Not that I'm saying the Galaxy is, but they can be perceived that way. So I think that it should be working out better than it is. I think the league at some point should take action and try and settle this situation. I don't think they will, because I think, again, you have a very tight-knit ownership group that they don't want any action that they take to come back to haunt them. So color me optimistic, or color me pessimistic, that anything will happen.
Yeah, I guess that's the one. That's the big question of the league at the moment, because while 18 sides are doing well, 19 is not doing well at all. And Earl, with this news about these three players, I know Villarreal from the Galaxy is there on loan at Cruz Azul, and as we talked about, Michael Farfan is with Cruz Azul now, and Baca from San Jose is also with Cruz Azul. Talking about these young players, do you think at the moment, while it's nice for the national team, if these kids will represent the U.S., do you think it's really tough not to see these type of young, talented players staying in MLS, and maybe something needs to be shaken up, things need to change? Should we, you know, keep half of single entity? Should it be gone completely and just go with a straight-up salary cap? I mean, what do you see with this?
Oh, boy, that's a loaded question. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, I think, is indicative on, now, granted, Villarreal comes from the Galaxy, who have oodles and oodles of money, it seems. And so maybe that's why, if that's only a loan deal, I didn't hear that. But if that's only a loan deal, I guess that's indicative of that. Baca and Farfan come from San Jose and Philadelphia, respectively, which fans of either team would pretty much say that it's clear they aren't looking to be out spending buku dollars. And if you know, they get the right offer from a transfer fee for most of their players, they're probably willing to listen. You know, I think that's somewhat indicative of the league itself, that the teams in the league are willing to take money. And I, kudos to a team like Kansas City that's been able to use this retention policy to keep players like Graham Soucy and, you know, Matt Beisler, and the Galaxy have kept Gonzalez, making him a young designated player. You know, that's a good thing for the league. What's not clear is how that's going to affect the national team. You know, maybe it's a good thing for a guy like Jose Villarreal to get some playing experience outside the country. I think a lot of us would like to see Matt Beisler get over to England and face some of the top attacking talent in the world to ready himself for Brazil, and that, now that's not going to happen. So unless he goes on loan, which I haven't heard if there are any rumors about that or not, but, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I think it helps the marketability of Major League Soccer. I think it might hamper the development of certain players who could grow, especially defensive players who could really stand to face better opposition than what they'll find on a week-to-week basis in Major League Soccer. If that answers your question.
Yep, absolutely there. Yeah, no, that does answer my question, actually. No, I think that's a great answer, and hopefully we'll see something happen here. And, Robert, as we continue on here, obviously, let me go a little more local for you, Robert, the stadium deal. How's that been progressing, and will there be some signs of construction machines at the grounds of where they want to build a new stadium?
Yeah, it's you know, DC's been kind of trying to wrap up some business here in the waning days of 2013. So I don't know if I'm as current as I might be. I know that the plan for acquiring the land is going before the DC Council. I'm not sure when the vote's going to be. I know that it's going to be probably a tight vote, just because everybody on the DC Council, and I don't mean that actually, I don't mean that sarcastically. I mean almost literally everybody on the council is running for mayor next year. There's going to be some politics involved in this. Unfortunately, that was timed with a story that was leaked that the owner of the Washington Nationals, or the ownership group of the Washington Nationals, went to the city council and asked for the city to pay for a dome for the stadium. This is not, again, this is not The Onion. I am not making this up. So that contentious issue comes up again, and we'll see what the politics look like. I think there's some optimism with the true DC United fans, and I say true fans, the people who have seen all this before and have gone through the various iterations of a new stadium proposals. So I think there's some cautious optimism, but we're still a little ways away from shoveling the dirt and planning out the ticket packages in the new stadium. Although I will note that the DC United website advertising the 2014 season ticket packages does list priority for seating in the new stadium as one of the benefits. So they're still optimistic.
So basically, Robert, you're just praying to God that you get your special seats when the new stadium is built.
Yeah, I just would like to see the stadium built at this point.
Robert, just admit it, you want your seats 24 karat gold.
Well, as a non-DC resident, I don't think that's even an option for me.
Come on, you got pull. You know you work for the government. Come on. No.
No, I don't work for the government. That's probably part of the problem.
Send the gold my way.
What it is. Okay, gentlemen, this question's for both of you. Go with Earl first, and then when Earl's done, Robert, you answer next. Jurgen
All right.
Klinsmann will be with U.S. Soccer as the head coach for the next cycle going to Russia 2018. Earl, do you think it was too early for U.S. Soccer to offer Klinsmann this extension?
I don't think so. I think given the way that the draw went for Brazil, I think this was sort of a hand across the aisle, so to speak, to say, you know what, this is going to be a difficult ask for the U.S. to progress out of the group stages. So let's take the pressure off. Let's say, you know what, we're going to be going with our current plan going forward. Klinsmann has made clear progress. You know, the progress may not be manifested in a solid result in Brazil. I think it will. I think the U.S. can actually use this as sort of a rallying cry, this sort of, you know, what seems to be a hard draw. So, you know, but even said, you know, having said that, I don't think that they wanted any pressure that, you know, heads are going to roll if things don't happen in Brazil. So I don't think it's too early. We'll just see if this if this has any effect on the campaign next year. I think it'll be okay. I think when they seem to play well with their backs against the wall, and this is definitely a situation where it seems like the cards are stacked against them. If they were to finish second in this group, they have to face Belgium in the next round. So I mean that in itself is pretty tough too. So you know, not an easy road, but I think the Klinsmann decision was a good one, and you know, hopefully that remains true 2 or 3 years down the road when we're looking back on it.
Yeah, I've changed my opinion on this issue. Initially, I was really kind of disappointed in U.S. soccer for doing a knee-jerk reaction and giving an extension right away when we haven't even played a World Cup game. But the more I think about it, you know, Earl's reasoning is very good, and I think there's the additional fact of there's going to be a competitive market this year for head coaches, both at the club level in Europe and then in the international market. So I think that, as you see in a lot of times in American sports, especially college sports, college football and college basketball, whenever there's a nice job opened up, you'll always see a coach rumored to be at that job, and they usually end up with a nice extension there just because the coach or someone related to him will sit there and try and get the nice little payday for themselves. I think this is what that kind of was. U.S. Soccer sitting there saying, we don't want to be dragged through the 100 Jurgen Klinsmann rumors, one of them, which may be true, and we're just going to lock them up. And that's probably a good thing, I mean, for the continuity of the program. Usually, you know, two-cycle coaches don't work out well, but I think in this case it probably was a good idea to just keep him on as the coach for another cycle and then hopefully transition him into a leadership role in the U.S. soccer structure.
Yeah, I will have to agree. I think the big rumors were, of course, Tottenham after they fired Andreas Villas-Boas, that maybe after the World Cup that Jurgen might be going to the EPL and maybe managing Tottenham, but of course that's not the case any longer. And finally, gentlemen, this is not a question. This is more of a comment. First of all, let me just say, it's always a pleasure to work with you guys. It's always a pleasure, whether it's on this show, what we've done in the past, or on your U.S. of Football podcast. And it's not just you two or my colleagues. I consider you two friends. And let me just say this before I let you both go. Thank you so much for your time. And I really do appreciate whenever you're available to come on. And, you know, good luck in 2014 with what you guys do. And, of course, in your lives and families. Happy holidays to both of you, and of course, mazel tov to both of you as well.
Oh, I forgot the tissues.
Earl's always been the sentimental one of the three of us. But yeah, thanks, Daniel, for having us on, and for I'll speak for myself, for you know, allowing me to talk uninhibited by you know, my own restrictions on my own podcast and things like that. It's always a pleasure to converse with you and your guest, and it's always a great to listen. So, and happy holidays to you and your fam as well.
And Daniel, yeah, I really appreciate, you know, you've given me a chance to speak when I was just basically starting out, and, you know, I appreciate you, you know, opening up the podcast or the show, you know, for my opinion, whether it's good or not, I guess, is up to the listener. But thanks for that, and for always being willing to come on and help out our show whenever we ask. And, yeah, I think in general, we seem to mesh well together, I hope, and hopefully the listeners agree. If not, they can take it up with you, I guess. Send
well,
your
you know
opinions
what I'll say
to
that.
Daniel Feuerstein.
yes, Feuersteinsfire.com, no. All right, well, listen, thanks a lot for coming on. Have a good night. Happy holidays to both of you, and take care, guys. I'll see you in the new year.
Cheers.
Same to you. Thanks.
No problem. That's Earl Reed and Robert Hay, Jr., from the U.S. Football Podcast. This has been the last show of 2014. Thank you very much for listening, guys. Happy New Year. Merry Christmas and everything else. Thanks to everyone that's been a part of this show. Thanks to everyone who has been assisting on this. You make the show go well. And it's time to say goodnight. It's time to say goodbye. I'll see you guys after my two-week break, January 14th, 2014. We restart everything going on. Once again, my name is Daniel Feuerstein, and for the final time in 2013, please, I beg of you to enjoy your football. Thank you. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye for the end of 2013. Bye-bye now.